Hello and welcome to Lush, and a podcast in the series The People's Manifesto for Wildlife Revisited. Dave Goulson is Professor of Biology at the University of Sussex, specialising in the ecology and conservation of insects, particularly bumblebees. He's been warning about the toxicity of pesticides and their threat to biodiversity for many years, and was a contributor to the People's Manifesto as the Minister for Pesticides. My name is Charlie Moores, and I spoke with Dave in his rather lovely garden, which is home to a flock of domesticated ducks and a turkey. His contribution to the People's Manifesto was radical and ambitious, with many interesting proposals. We cover a number of them over the next 30 minutes, but we began by discussing what's been called the cocktail effect. So Dave, in your contribution to the People's Manifesto, you talked about the massive barrage of poisons farmland is subjected to, and the combined effects being far beyond the capacity of scientists to predict or understand. Can we start with that point, that it's the combination of so many pesticides being used, that cocktail effect that is so dangerous to biodiversity?
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated subject that most people know nothing about, and fair enough. But basically, we are farmers and homeowners apply an awful lot of pesticides these days. It's become a habit for almost all farms use huge amounts. The latest figures are 16.9 thousand tons of pesticides a year applied just to the UK by farmers, and that doesn't include domestic use or local authorities and so on.
That's just on farmland?
It's just on farmland. Wow. There are about 500 different pesticides licensed for use in the EU by farmers. Now, they're all evaluated. You know, they have to go through quite a complicated regulatory process that's meant to make sure that they're safe for the environment. But we repeatedly have found in the past that, you know, chemicals that have got through those tests have actually turned out to be much more harmful than the tests had picked up. More persistent, they're accumulating in food chains, they're having all sorts of unexpected consequences. And also, the interactions between chemicals are impossible to predict, and they're not studied at all. So when a company comes up with a new chemical that they want to bring, a new pesticide, bear in mind that, I mean, pesticides are basically poison. That's what, you know, they're all designed to kill something. They're tested against a few key organisms. So, for example, my interest is in insects, and the honeybee is the standard test organism. So compound X will be fed to honeybees to see what dose kills them, and it's usually done over a 24 or 48 hour acute toxicity test. So basically, you feed some bees your pesticide at different doses and you see what dose is required to kill them. And they're classified as either alive or dead. So after the 24 hours, the bee, if it's still alive, then that's considered fine. If it's dead, it's dead. Poor things. But the reality is that the world is much more complicated than that. And in the real world, bees aren't exposed to one chemical at a time. We now know that if you look at, for example, honey samples, they're often contain 20 or 30 different pesticides. So bees and other insects, and in probably all wildlife, is being continually exposed kind of chronically throughout its life to this complicated mixture of pesticides. And so are we, in fact. And nobody has tested the combined effects of pesticides on any of us or any wildlife. And it turns out, for example, that that some fungicides, which on their own are not at all toxic to honeybees, it takes a huge dose to do them any harm, but those fungicides, they block the detoxification mechanism that the honeybee has. So if the honeybee is simultaneously exposed to a tiny amount of insecticide, that becomes much more potent and it kills the bee at a much lower dose if it's mixed with the fungicide. And that wasn't picked up at all by the regulatory tests and can't be because they don't look at mixtures.
I will get on to the regulatory procedures in a second because you talk about those in the manifesto as well. But just to reiterate that point, it's this cocktail effect, the fact that the tests do not test putting all these pesticides together and seeing what happens when you release them all into the environment at the same time.
Yeah, you can't really extrapolate from testing in the lab in very unnatural conditions, one chemical at a time, and then trying to predict what will happen when farmers apply thousands of tons of a whole cocktail of different pesticides to the landscape. They're so different. There's so many things that you can't extrapolate. One I didn't just mention is also sublethal effects. There are really no studies of sublethal effects. So the honeybee at the end of the test, if it's alive, it's just that's deemed to be fine. It may not be able to fly or navigate or remember who the hell it is. Maybe totally dazed and confused, but that's not picked up by these tests at all. And in reality, insects need to be able to navigate and remember where the food is and things like that. So that's, you know, yet another part of the whole process which is just completely inadequate.
You mentioned over 16,000 tons being dumped on farmland every year. Do we know exactly what the proportions of each pesticide is within that 16,000 tonnes?
The UK is unusual in the DEFRA report pesticide use in a pretty detailed way. So yes, the bulk of it is fungicides followed by herbicides, with insecticides being the smallest of those three big groups in terms of weight applied. But then the insecticides used are fantastically toxic. So yeah, the weight isn't perhaps the most useful thing to keep an eye on. It, you also need to bear in mind how potent these chemicals are. Some are much more potent than others.
And once again, we don't know how potent they are in combination with others and what effects they're having. It's crazy, isn't it? In your proposals as well, you suggested a target of a 50% reduction in the weight of pesticides used and the number of pesticide applications per field. You wanted that reduction by 2022, so that was written in 2018. A year's gone by. I'm assuming not much has been achieved in reducing pesticide use.
There's been no action taken by government to reduce pesticide use at all that I'm aware of. The government seems frozen here, I guess because of Brexit looming and the consequences of potentially leaving the common agricultural policy. So until we know whether we're in or out, it's pretty difficult to make any sensible changes, I suppose. But nothing has happened. So the number of applications currently standing at about 17 per field in terms
that's
of...
That's a staggering
it's
figure.
It's pretty astonishing, isn't it? You know, the average field that you drive past in your car is being... That crop is receiving 17 different pesticide applications. That's not to say the farmer sprays it 17 times. He could spray it once with a mixture of 17 different chemicals or 17 different times or any combination of the above.
Sure.
But it's still... And that has doubled in the last 25 years. Farmers are using more and more applications than they used to. It seems that it's kind of like an addiction. I think a lot of it's just based on marketing pressure. You know, the companies that sell these chemicals, they are pretty effective. They employ most of the agronomists that advise farmers what to do, how to manage their crops. And if, you know, basically if you're a salesman working on commission, then of course you're going to tell the farmer to use lots of your products.
Yeah. You would have thought, though, over the years, the pesticides themselves would become more efficient and you would need less of them, therefore. You're telling a different story. You're saying, actually,
so
amount
the
is going up all the time.
Well, so the weight applied has come down while the number of sprays has gone up. But the weight has come down primarily because we've switched to using more toxic compounds. So, for example, if you compare... neonicotinoids, which are these very controversial insecticides, to DDT, which was kind of the first insecticide that came on the market in the 1940s. The neonicotinoids are about 7,000 times more poisonous to insects than DDT. DDT seems quite benign with hindsight. Of course, it isn't at all. I wouldn't want to go back to DDT because that caused horrendous problems with bioaccumulation in food chains and so on.
Yeah.
But weight for weight, farmers have to apply far, far less of these new compounds because they are so much more powerful. But that's not to say that the environmental effect is any less. I did recently calculate over the last 25 years how the kind of net effect of this changing volume and changing potency affects the... It's maybe a bit of a strange calculation, but you can work out if you took all the pesticides applied to the UK and fed them to honeybees, how many bees could you kill? I mean, of course, you know, you'd kill them all hundreds of times over, in fact. But what I was interested in is how has that changed over time. So over the last 25 years, the chemicals used today would kill about six times as many honeybees as the chemicals used 25 years ago by farmers. So that's the kind of combination of reduced weight being applied, but they're much more potent, which more than offsets the reduced volume.
Pesticide manufacturers would of course say that their aim is not to kill honeybees. You can't avoid that, can you, if you're spraying pesticides into the environment?
Sadly, no one's, you know, produced an insecticide that just kills the bad insects, you know, the aphids or whatever the target is, and doesn't harm the good ones. And in the countryside, there are a host of important insects that would control the insect pests if they had half a chance if they weren't all being killed, or at least partly control them. And of course, there are all the pollinators, not just honeybees, but hundreds of other species of bee, wasp, butterfly, moth, and so on, all of which are killed by insecticides. It's not possible to produce a chemical that just kills the ones you want to kill. So, you know, if you're applying thousands of tons of poison to the landscape, sadly, there's going to be enormous collateral damage. It's unavoidable.
Yeah. The argument's always given, Dave, that pesticides are essential to feed the world, that the world would lose too many crops without herbicides, fungicides and insecticides. You tackled that argument head on in the manifesto.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. But if you compare organic farming with conventional farming, the yield's really not that much lower, nowhere near as low as people might think. There's been some big studies on this, and organic farming produces about just over 80% of the yield of conventional farming. And actually, most of that yield difference is due to fertilizers, not pesticides. The pesticides, they do, you know, overall increase yield a tiny bit, but it's really not that much. And if you think that currently we waste a third of all the food that's produced in the world. And isn't that nuts, you know? And it would be impossible to get rid of all waste, but we could certainly greatly reduce that. You know, to do all this intensive farming, produce all this food, and then throw away a third of it is just nuts.
That's around the world, isn't
that's
it?
That's a global estimate. And then on top of that, we have growing global meat consumption. So about a third of all the crops grown in the world are not fed to people at all. They're fed to animals to then feed to people, which is just a stupidly inefficient way of feeding people. So if we all just ate a bit less meat and were less wasteful with our food, the whole world could go organic tomorrow and there'd be easily enough food to feed people. People often say we need to feed the world, that's why we need intensive farming. Way more than enough food in the world right now. There's about three times as much food produced as actually is required to feed everybody. It's just so much of it is being wasted or used really inefficiently to feed to animals.
Yeah. You said there that organic farming is about 80% as efficient. You pointed out in the manifesto that there's been scarcely any investment in organic farming, and that yield could easily be increased.
Absolutely. I mean, billions is spent on R&D in, you know, developing new pesticides and so on, and developing new crop varieties that are suited to intensive farming. There's almost zero investment. It's less than 1% of all investment in research in farming is into organic farming. So, you know, one can only suspect that gap could be closed considerably if actually there was a tiny bit of investment in it.
You also suggested introducing a pesticide tax, which is an idea I hadn't heard of, but apparently is being used in Europe in some countries already.
Yeah, some countries have done so. Denmark's probably the best known example. They've introduced a kind of, it's a bit complicated, but basically they try to tax more heavily the chemicals which seem to be more harmful, which makes perfect sense. And it seems reasonable to me. I think most people accept that there should be some kind of polluter pays principle here. And just, you know, to give one example, slug pellets, metaldehyde, which has been used by every farmer more or less for many decades.
And many gardeners now, sadly.
Of course, many gardeners. It's being withdrawn, in fact, but for many decades it's been used. It gets into drinking water, and it's extremely difficult to remove from drinking water. There's no easy way to extract it, so it's a massive headache for water companies trying to provide clean water for people. They end up spending millions of pounds, which is then passed on to the consumer in higher water bills, trying to get this pesticide. So it seems to me that the farmer should be, if they're the one polluting the water, they should be paying to clean it up, essentially.
Wouldn't that just result in higher food prices? I'm assuming that's the argument that's always given in opposition of a tax on pesticides.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps it's unfair to, I don't want to put all the burden on the farmer here. You know, we have this whole system which is dysfunctional, if you like. Farmers are struggling to make a living very often because they're squeezed by the supermarkets who take the majority of the profit for themselves. I think food is too cheap at the moment. We have this kind of bizarre system where people are so used to really cheap food that they say that, for example, organic food is too expensive for most people to buy. But actually, people are spending hardly anything on food these days compared to what they used to spend historically. Yeah. I saw some recent estimates that suggest that if you go back 100 years, people used to spend about half their income roughly on food, and now it's about 8 or 9%. So, you know, people say they can't afford a bag of organic carrots, but they've got an iPhone 6 in their pocket.
Yeah,
you think,
where
are your priorities here? Yeah. So it's really complicated to sort these things out. But I mean, one thing I think is we somehow need to persuade people to value healthy food that's been grown in a sustainable way and to be prepared to pay a little bit more for it so that farmers can afford to produce it. Yeah. And at present, that, you know, that isn't happening.
That would lead us into things like the badger coal, but let's not go down that particular rabbit hole in this discussion. You referred to this briefly right at the start of the conversation about pesticide use in public parks. And obviously, you'd like to see a ban on that, which just seems eminently sensible, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, and there are precedents for this. You know, there are lots of cities in the world that have declared themselves pesticide-free years ago in some cases. Toronto did this more than a decade ago. And, you know, Toronto still has parks with nice flowers and gardens.
Yeah.
And it's in fact, you can't tell us anything different, you know. So it's perfectly possible. France recently declared that they're banning all pesticides in urban areas. Every city in France is now a pesticide-free zone. And if France can do it, why can't everybody do it?
And they've got a very strong agricultural lobby.
They have.
That's quite surprising.
They've gone down that route. They also, although they have a strong agricultural lobby, I think the French are more wary of pesticides and always have been. They seem to be more concerned about healthy food and a healthy environment than perhaps we are here. But anyway, so you know, we basically don't need pesticides in parks. And when you think about it, actually the main pesticide used in parks is glyphosate. Three court cases have been brought in the United States, and in each case where someone was claiming that their cancer was caused by exposure to glyphosate. Two of them gardeners, and one was a guy who was basically a groundskeeper. And in every case, all three cases, the juries were unanimous that glyphosate was the likely cause of the cancer. And we're spraying this in children's parks.
It's the world's most widely sold
weed killer,
isn't it?
It's the most widely used pesticide of any type in the world. It's the biggest seller.
And in fact, if you went into a lot of people's houses or their garden sheds, they would have a bottle of glyphosate on the shelf, I'm really embarrassed to admit
that there's a bottle in that shed over there. I haven't opened it for about 5 years, but I used to use it because I stupidly, naively, like everybody else, I bought the idea that that it was safe, that it degraded as soon as it hit the ground, which was what we were all told.
Yeah.
That, you know, so it was not at all persistent and that it was only toxic to plants. Well, it turns out it's toxic to bees. It seems now quite likely that it causes cancer in people. It turns out it's much more persistent than anyone realized, and it gets into food. It's actually in most breakfast cereals and cookies, anything made with wheat, basically. And it turns out that it's probably wise not to ever use the stuff again. And I certainly won't ever use it again, but I've still got a bottle of the darn stuff in the shed.
Most of it is sold under the brand name Roundup, isn't it?
So yeah.
You see adverts every spring as the dandelions start to come up.
Yeah.
We're urged to reach for the Roundup.
Shed there and blast away with this stuff. I mean, you know, and you think as well, you know, you can buy it in the supermarket. As far as I know, there's no age restrictions on buying it. People using it probably have no idea about the possible health risks associated. It probably says, you know, that you should take precautions and wear gloves or whatever, but how many people actually bother, you know? They probably spray a bit extra for luck, because these are completely untrained people using potent poison in their gardens. It's just nuts. And you know, if there are some dandelions, either dig them up. Yeah, it's really not in a garden setting. If you really don't want the dandelions, you can get rid of them without using glyphosate. It's not that hard. Or let them flower. You know, bees love dandelions.
They're
beautiful. This whole idea that we have to persecute some plant species because somebody decided they were weeds is completely...
It's a real bugbear of mine, just as I know it is of yours. It's crazy.
Yeah, it drives me nuts, you know. I mean, you can get rid of all the weeds in your garden in the blink of an eye by just calling them wildflowers and being done with it. Let them get on with it. Who needs a perfect lawn with just grass? What's that all about?
No, it's a perception we've been sold, isn't it? And, you know, we've been sold a lot of perceptions over the years, including that it's perfectly safe to spray Roundup all over the garden. It doesn't do any harm to anything apart from a few flowers that you don't really want, do you?
It's strange, isn't it? The human desire to kind of control to anything that, you know, even mildly inconveniences us, or that we decide is the wrong plant in the wrong place or whatever. We have to kill it all the time. We're bloody, you know, rushing around buying poisons and killing things or killing them in other ways. And you just need to be a bit more gentle and tolerant with the world. You know, we can't all, there's too many people now for us all to just go around killing anything that we don't like the look of, because there'd be nothing left if we carry on.
And half the time we're not even sure why we don't like the look of it.
Yeah, you see, I mean, if you look on the bottles of insecticide available in the garden centre, there's pictures of woodlice and earwigs on them as things that you might be wanting to kill. Well, you know, they're beneficial organisms that we shouldn't be trying to kill at all. People should be encouraging them. But it just gives this general impression that basically, you know, most insects are pests that should be disposed of unless it's a pretty butterfly or a bee.
You opened your contribution to the People's Manifesto and you referred to this right at the start, and I said we'd come back to this, but... You said that the regulatory system for pesticides has repeatedly failed to prevent harmful chemicals from being approved for use in our countryside. I'm not the expert on this, but it seems to me that it's the power of the lobbyists and the threat of legal action seems to be behind that failure. Do you share that opinion, or have you got a more nuanced view from as you've been studying this for much longer?
So there is an interesting example here, which is that we now know that the current regulatory process isn't adequate because it's repeatedly failed. Right from the beginning, back in the 1940s, you know, things like DDT, which came in and then it took 30 years to realise how harmful it was. But it's still up to relatively recent times with the neonicotinoids that came in the mid-1990s and, you know, were subsequently discovered to be much more dangerous to the environment than anyone had realised. And now most of those have finally been banned after 25 years of use. But the regulatory system that neonicotinoids came through has not changed. So there is nothing to stop a new neonicotinoid or, you know, similarly harmful chemical coming to market. The European Food Standards Agency did develop a much more detailed procedure for evaluating risks to bees, which try to take into account sublethal effects and effects on species other than honeybees, which are not normally looked at. It doesn't go as far as looking at cocktail effects, but still, it would be a big step in the right direction. So there's a whole protocol been developed to produce a more rigorous regulatory process, but it's been blocked. It's never actually been implemented. It's been around now for about 5 or 6 years.
Blocked by whom? I guess that's what I'm asking.
Exactly. Well, it's very hard to know. Well, no, it's not very hard to know. It's obvious exactly who's doing it. The companies that produce the chemicals, it would be more expensive and there'd be a bigger risk the chemicals wouldn't get through if this new procedure were implemented. So basically, you know, these are big, powerful companies. They make billions and billions of pounds a year from selling these chemicals. And so they influence their governments. And so the different European countries, some of them have blocked implementing this proposal. And it's basically kind of a stalemate. And in the meantime, you know, new products are coming onto the market. We've seen some new insecticides arrive. They give them great unpronounceable names. We've got cyantranilipril, sulfoxaflor, fluppy, is that it's often called, flupyradifurone. I sometimes think they deliberately give them long names so that no one can pronounce them or remember what the hell they are. But all three of those look suspiciously like new generation neonicotinoids, but they've been branded as other chemicals.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you about that because I'd read that they changed the formula ever so slightly and just enough to say, no, it's not the same chemical at all. Look. And now it's called floppy noppy. It's not the same thing.
So usually chemicals are classified according to what they chemically target in the target pest or in an insect. So neonicotinoids are neurotoxins. They bind onto acetylcholine receptors in the brain of insects. Nobody needs to know the details of this. These new chemicals bind to exactly the same target site. They basically mess up the brain of insects and paralyze them and kill them, exactly like neonicotinoids do. So as far as I can see, they ought to be called neonicotinoids. But the chemical industry has given them new names. It claims that they're not neonicotinoids. And of course, you know, it's very obvious why, because neonicotinoids would immediately be a red flag. But if they call them butanolides, then nobody knows what the heck anyone's talking about. And they come through the regulatory process unscathed and go onto the market. And then, you know, probably 25 years from now, we'll be talking about what a disaster sulfoxaflor was. But it'll take that long before independent scientists have chance to really evaluate them.
Those evaluation processes do take a very long time, don't they? I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but I would assume that the chemical industry is quite glad that it takes a very long time for these checks to be made.
Yeah, well, so it's interesting, actually. The big profit is made from a chemical in the first few years of sale, because it depends where you are in the world, but basically the company that invented it gets exclusive license to manufacture. It's the same as, drugs in human health.
Medicines and headache pills and whatever
exactly.
It is.
Yeah. And nobody else can make it for the first 10 years or whatever it is. So that's when they make their money. And then it goes off license and anyone can make it, and the price drops and the profit goes. So actually, if after 15, 20 years, a chemical is banned and has to be replaced by a new one, which they've got exclusive license to sell.
That's a good thing.
It's actually in their interests that scientists eventually discover that their chemicals are harmful.
So just as the old one is beginning to be not worth very much because everyone can make it, that gets banned and they come along and go, well, we've got a new one
just
here.
Just so happens we've got a new
they
one.
They hold the patent and the license for the next 10 years and so it goes on.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and we've seen, so we've had the organochlorides, the DDT and so on. We've got the organophosphates, both of which were eventually banned, the neonicotinoids banned. Endless pesticides have come and gone. We're just recently a fungicide, chlorothalonil, which farmers have been using for 50 years, just been banned because it realized it's actually much more toxic, not just to fungi, but to a whole bunch of different organisms than anyone had realized. But that one took 50 years to spot.
Wow.
It's a frustrating business. You know, we just feel like we're going round and round in circles. It's just kind of a merry-go-round, change the system and break away from this, you know, reliance on basically some kind of chemical to solve the problem, and look for what's the alternative to a chemical at all, then we're not going to get anywhere.
That's what we do need to be looking at, like organic farming, which uses no chemicals, versus farming that uses lots, rather than trying to change what chemicals are being used.
If one's completely logical and rational about this, probably there's a halfway house. So people often use this phrase integrated pest management, which is basically treating the pesticide as the last resort. You encourage biocontrol agents like ladybirds and hoverflies and lacewings, and there are, you use resistant crop varieties and crop rotations. There's a whole bunch of tools out there that don't involve chemicals, but you fall back on the pesticide if nothing else has worked in that particular year or whatever. Probably that's the best way to grow food, but the trouble is, if you have pesticides allowed at all, then you allow the companies that produce them to market them, to push them, to, you know, try and persuade farmers to use more of them. And it's really difficult to keep that in check.
Yeah.
So the simple solution is to go organic and say, well, let's just forget the darn things. We can manage without them. And we can, you know, we could easily feed the world without using any pesticides at all. And so I think, you know, pragmatically, that's the way to go, because any kind of halfway house just doesn't really work.
Have any studies been done on how long it would take the chemicals that are in the environment now to decay or to be at such low levels that they're not causing any harm?
It depends enormously on the chemical. For example, you and I almost certainly got DDT lodged in our fat. It'll be there until we die. It's fat soluble. It accumulated during the period DDT was being used in the 60s, 70s, 80s. So anyone who was alive from the 80s or earlier has got DDT and a few other nasty organochloride chemicals lodged in their bodies. You can't get rid of them. But probably the amounts there aren't going to do us any harm. But those chemicals last for decades and decades in the environment. Neonicotinoids, we know, are in soil for certainly 3, 4, 5 years, maybe longer. There was some recent studies in up in northern England where they sampled soil and found imidacloprid in it, even though the farmers hadn't been applying any for the, that chemical had been replaced by others about 5 years earlier, but there was still plenty in the soil. So they, you know, they hang around for years, some much less. You know, pyrethroid insecticides tend to go within a few months, or in some cases a few days.
So they aren't quite at the level that plastic pollution is, say, for example. These things don't tend to break down into microchemicals and that linger for potentially hundreds of years.
No, well, it's not the same. I mean, you know, the reality is that 1,000 years from now, the beaches of the world will still contain a significant proportion of plastic particles in mixed up with the sand. You know, we've done that to the planet and we can't undo it, and there's nothing we can do to remove it. But the pesticides will go sooner than that, thankfully.
Right.
But obviously the sooner we stop using them, the sooner they'll disappear.
This is a very confusing subject. Is there anything or any information that you recommend to cut through that confusion? Is there a source that you would say, anyone interested, this is where you go?
There's an organisation called PAN, Pesticide Action Network, who have a really useful website, which is generally, you know, they promote alternatives to pesticides, essentially, and they're a pretty clued up organisation. They've got a particular focus on urban areas and urban pesticides and how we can do without them. So it's a great place if you're a gardener or involved in managing parks and streets and road verges and so on. Great place for advice. I think that would be my first suggestion.
It's probably easier than trying to dive straight into scientific papers, isn't it?
It's so complicated. I mean, even as a specialist in the field, you know, I really struggle to keep up. And, for example, the glyphosate story and whether or not it's a carcinogen and so on, you know, I'm not a medic. And I find it bewildering, you know, how, because there are hundreds of papers being published, some of them, it turns out, you know, are actually sort of secretly written by the industry. So you can't trust the independence of the science now. And that's a really dangerous situation to be in. You know, as a scientist myself, I feel that trust in science is being eroded quite rapidly. And where does that leave us? If you can't believe stuff that's in peer-reviewed scientific journals, then where do we find the truth? You know, it's a really difficult world that we're going into.
Yeah. If you were to rewrite or to be asked to redraft the manifesto, because it was Chris Packham when he published it, said this is the first edit, would there be anything you'd change? Or,
well, the sad truth is I wouldn't change much, because basically nothing has changed. We're in the same boat, you know. We're still, from a UK perspective, you know, we're still waiting to see what happens with Brexit. We had Michael Gove making some pretty positive noises, you know, talking about redirecting farm subsidies to pay for public goods. Exactly what he meant was never quite clear.
When he was Environment Secretary.
When he was Environment Secretary, yeah. So a year ago, when the first manifesto was written, he talked about a green Brexit and how, you know, freeing ourselves from European restrictions would enable Britain to you know, revitalise farming in a more sustainable way. And so it all sounded great.
It did, didn't it?
He even talked about soil health, which I've never heard an environment minister mention soil before. But,
yeah, yeah.
But then, you know, inevitably he's moved on to another job. I have no idea what Teresa Villiers' qualifications are as the new Environment Secretary. But until we know whether we're in or out of Europe and whether, therefore, you know, we're in the common agricultural policy or not, no decisions seem to be being made at all. And, of course, the real danger is one thing that has changed since a year ago is a no-deal Brexit seems pretty likely right now, although, you know, by tomorrow that might have changed completely. If that happens, then we're going to be cutting deals with Donald Trump and the likes. And those trade deals, a lot of it will be about the food.
Yeah.
And we'll be importing stuff with, you know, America has much lower standards for example, whereas Europe has 500 pesticides available for farmers to use, in North America there are 900. The neonicotinoids, for example, are all still freely available to farmers to use there. So we'll be importing food with much lower environmental standards. We may even end up adopting their environmental standards ourselves as part of that trade deal, which is a terrifying prospect. But of course, we haven't, you know, nobody knows what the heck is going to happen at the moment.
Oh, we'll end there on that
that cheerful note.
Cheerful note. Professor Goulson, Dave, thank you very much indeed.
It's been a pleasure as always.
Professor Dave Goulson talking with me in September 2019. An author as well as an academic, Dave's latest book, The Garden Jungle or Gardening to Save the Planet, was published by Vintage Publishing in July this year and has already garnered rave reviews. The first draft of the manifesto, as it was titled by Chris Packham, can be downloaded from Chris's website at chrispackham.co.uk. An updated version of the manifesto is apparently due later this year with additional contributions and will be well worth looking out for. Thank you very much for listening. If you'd like to hear more from conservationists like Dave and many other campaigners and researchers, please go to player.lush.com and search Charlie Moores, or head over to our new website at waronwildlife.co.uk.